Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Imagine a civil rights regime that seeks to carve out space for people to be themselves fully. A regime that values expressions of individuality as central to the human experience. Imagine that the law recognizes a right to shave your head, a right to be fat, a right to be open about your same-sex partner, a right to wear your hair in braids, a right to transition from one sex to another, a right to have tattoos, a right to speak a language other than English. These examples are drawn from real cases, all of which point to a common problem. Civil rights law is stuck in the past. Time and time again, discrimination claimants find themselves shut out of a legal system that still views the group as the focal point of discrimination. The future of civil rights must be about individuals, and our right to personality is the vehicle to make this happen. That is From Outsiders by Zachary Kramer, who is our guest today on New Books in Law, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. Professor Kramer is the Willard H. Pedrick Distinguished Research Scholar at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. Professor Kramer, welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, Kunga.
It was great to be able to read your book, which you described as an ode to difference.
Yes.
And the subhead is why difference is the future of civil rights.
That's right. I have to tell you up top that that was not the original subtitle of the book.
When I got
the contract, the one condition in the contract from Oxford was that I had to change the subtitle and that it had to start with the word why. And so the initial subtitle was The Future of Civil Rights. And the board of editors agreed unanimously that it was too vague. And we didn't have a new subtitle until the book was already done with copy edits. It was getting ready to be sent to the printer. And a couple of us sat down and decided that we would email each other back and forth until we locked it in. And so we ended up at Why Difference is the Future of Civil Rights, which I'm very happy with. But it's one of those funny things where it always bumps in my head as I hear it.
Well, it's always nice to get an insight into the production process there.
Sure.
But I guess if we're thinking about the future of civil rights, it might be important to understand the present or the past of civil rights. Could you lay out the current landscape?
Sure. Yeah. So civil rights means a lot of different things. And it's one of those legal concepts that is broad and touches on a lot of aspects of law. I'm specifically thinking about statutory civil rights, laws like the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and some similar statutes like the ADA, some housing stuff. So I'm mainly thinking about rules that reach in both the public and then also into the private sphere, and specifically about employment. I tend to write mostly about employment. The book kind of picks up on whether or not the landscape is changing in civil rights. And in large part, I started thinking about writing the book in 2014, which was the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. There were all of these events that were going on around the country. I went to quite a few of them, spoke at a couple. And it's one of the things where you would expect the conversation at the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act would be celebratory, thinking about how much good the Civil Rights Act has done. But by and large, the ones I went to at least tended to be very depressing, with kind of a great unhappiness with civil rights law's ability to get things done today. So what does that mean specifically? I'm talking about areas of law or statutes that protect on the basis of race discrimination, sex discrimination, color discrimination, religious discrimination, disability discrimination, national origin. And there is this general sense that those laws were really good at wiping out one particular kind of discrimination, which is when employers explicitly embrace their discrimination. When they say, for example, you know, no women need apply, no blacks need apply, when there were workforces that had no people of color, no women, they were largely white and male, if not just white. And so the civil rights laws that we developed in the 60s and amended over time were very good at stamping out that kind of discrimination. They have been less good at getting more complicated forms of discrimination, possibly because identity traits blend in, intersectionality issues, stuff like that. And then also just cases where employers are either more sophisticated or it's harder to spot whether discrimination is taking place. My entry point into this is trying to think through both hard cases of discrimination. A lot of my writing has been about the relationship between sex and gender and sexual orientation as an example, and unpacking those identity traits and whether or not they are because of sex is an impossible question and one that courts have been really struggling with. And the more time I spent there, the more I began thinking about really all of the identity traits that we carry and that we wear and how a lot of them, if not most of them, are in fact not protected by civil rights, the civil rights laws, trying to imagine a universe in which we could protect all of them.
The imaginative work that you're doing, I think it turns on this distinction that you draw between being and doing. Could mm-hmm. you talk about how those are different, and especially how they're different in terms of one's identity?
Sure. So, you know, civil rights law in particular has never really done this well, because the laws are written to say that, for instance, employers can't take race into account or sex into account. And they do that by saying that they prohibit discrimination on the basis of those traits. But, you know, we all know that sometimes your race or your sex is the group that you belong to, and sometimes it is the behaviors that you engage in or the practices you practice. And so there is this kind of duality going on. And sometimes, for example, I am a Jew and sometimes I engage in Jewish behavior. And so discrimination can be targeted at both of those. It depends on the circumstances. And so what you end up seeing is in civil rights law is much better at discrimination that targets status, right? Your membership discrimination. It's really a lot less good at discrimination cases where it is a person kind of behaving in a certain way that they associate with their identity. And so examples of that from my own work, not just the book, are cases that kind of target masculinity and femininity. And so in those situations, you can easily make the argument that that is about your sex. If a man is behaving in an insufficiently masculine way or too femininely, that is an easy argument to say that it's sex. But courts oftentimes would say that that is not about your sex. It's about the kind of the way you're acting, and the way you're acting is not protected by civil rights law. My thinking on this is guided in a lot by areas of law that don't struggle with that distinction. So race discrimination law, sex discrimination law, they really have a hard time with this distinction between status and conduct, between being and doing. But religious discrimination law has it down and really understands that they're different, because within civil rights law's protections against religious discrimination, it is explicitly said that it protects people because of their religion, because of the status that they have as a person of faith in a particular faith group, or because of the behaviors they engage in. And so there is a difference, again, between being a Jew and keeping kosher. And what I'm really excited about in terms of thinking through that relationship is it gives people space to define how they want to understand their own identity. For example, I am a practicing Jew, but I don't keep kosher. I was a vegetarian for a long time, and there's complicated feelings within certain segments of the Jewish population and vegetarianism. And so civil rights law has, by and large, tried to eschew and get rid of distinctions like that. And my argument is, rather than ignore it, it should embrace it whole heart and make it central to its enterprise.
When you write about the current regime for protecting against religious discrimination, you point out that the law's overwhelming stance is one of liberal neutrality.
Yeah.
Can you expand what you mean by liberal neutrality and why that's desirable?
Sure. Well, so it's a practical necessity just given the First Amendment. And so the state is not supposed to be endorsing a religion. And so the way we have interpreted that, at the same time as you have your free exercise rights under the First Amendment, is that the courts don't get in the business of defining what religion is. And so they are neutral, right? But they're also, you know, liberal in the sense that they are willing to embrace pluralism, I mean, for lack of a better word. And so you have these cases in religious discrimination law where courts leave it up to the claimants to decide what their religion is. And so what you end up getting is this universe of faith that are kind of traditional religions, both in terms of identity and practices, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, but then also kind of practices. And so the act of, you know, ritual slaughter, for example, keeping a Sabbath, a fast would be kind of these traditional practices. But then it really extends even further down the continuum. And you have these cases where claimants are asserting claims of faith that are not kind of traditionally religious. And so some of those examples would be food preferences, the vegans and the vegetarians, where they're not saying that they are in fact religious, but the court's expectations is that the identity in question or the practice in question will occupy a person's life as if it was, as if it were faith. And so it holds that same place in your own moral view. And so that really opens the door for a really broad sense of what we would call religion. The only real restriction on religious discrimination law's definition of religion is that it not only occupy that space, but more importantly, that it be sincerely held. And so courts don't want people asserting a faith claim to basically get out of work. But so long as it occupies a space in your life that is like religion, and it's a belief or a practice that you sincerely hold to, courts are not in the business of saying what is and is not religion. And so it's a really big universe, and it's a really interesting thinking, interesting way of thinking about identity, not that it is in fact religious, but there are certain identity traits that we have, that we own, that occupy such an important place in our lives that they are akin to religion.
As we continue to talk about the current regime, you wrote that civil rights law is science fiction.
Yeah.
And you also wrote that civil rights law is like geometry.
Yep.
And I was wondering if you could expand on those similes.
Sure. I'm all about the simile. I'm deep in similes and rhetorical questions. So science fiction. Civil rights law is attempting to do something that is ultimately impossible, because you can't really prove discrimination unless someone admits to it. And so outside of the case where someone admits to engaging in discrimination, we have to use the law to determine whether discrimination exists. And so civil rights law is effectively trying to peer into the discriminator, the bad actor's mind, and try to figure out if they had this bad motive. And so if they don't tell you have a bad motive, the law will create these shortcuts and these evidentiary burdens to try to channel the information so we can conclude that there's been discrimination. I will tell you, years ago, I met someone here at ASU who asked me about my work, and I was talking about discrimination. And I made a joke that it was like mind reading. And he told me that There's some interesting work being done on mind reading and monkeys, and that he would be happy to introduce me to the people doing that work. And I was so overwhelmed by it that I could not possibly take it, take up that offer. But, you know, we are in the mind reading business in civil rights law practice because we're trying to peer into someone's mind and figure out whether or not they were doing something they shouldn't. You know, partly that's light, but the important point to draw from that is this is entirely an imperfect body of law, right? We are asking the law to do an incredible thing, and it's a very hard thing. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of lawyers and a lot of civil rights lawyers in particular are pretty sour on the ability of the law to really create wholesale change, because we are asking it to do a pretty big lift there. And so one of the things that I'm trying to do in the book is to try to come up with a new way of talking about civil rights law that might make it a little bit easier to at least have the conversation about whether or not a wrong has taken place and whether we can right that wrong. With regard to the other point, the geometry, a lot of the book is about the concept of the box. And one of my critiques of existing civil rights doctrine is that it's too tethered to this idea of protected classes. And so the statute says no discrimination on the basis of race, sex, national origin, color, and religion. It doesn't really define those terms, and it's left to courts to define those terms. And so the way courts tend to treat that framework is to say, if you are in a group that has that trait, you are protected. And so what ends up happening is the name of the game to get protection is to fit yourself into a box. And so courts are box patrollers, and they're trying to control the boundaries of that box. And so the quintessential example is LGBT people who have been for many years trying to get into the sex box within civil rights law. And that's actually an issue that's going up to the Supreme Court next term. And I'm very concerned about what's going to happen in those cases. But again, courts have the power to say who's in and who's not in. They don't actually, there's no mechanism for the people in that box to have a real say there. And so, you know, one of the refrains in the book is that the box is the problem and we're trying to get rid of the box. And the drawing of distinctions and the drawing of lines, I argue, is actually more problematic and takes us further away from equality as opposed to closer to equality, which is the goal.
And so I guess that's the virtue of the program of protecting against religious discrimination is that the courts aren't drawing these boxes that people have to come in and say, this, you know, I'm in this protected religion or that protected religion. Mm-hmm. The point is, yeah. I sincerely treat this as religious practice, therefore it is protected.
This issue of
sincerity, isn't that a mind-reading problem as well?
So there's always going to be a little mind reading in law, and civil rights law is not unique in this sense. But what I like about the mind reading in this case is you have to prove it, right? And so there's a case that I talk about in the book where involves a waiter at a hotel. He's Muslim, and he does not have a beard. And there's a rule at this workplace that you can't have facial hair if you are serving in this hotel catering position. And he's apparently late to work. I don't remember the facts completely, but he's late to work and he didn't shave and he gets penalized. And to avoid the effect of the penalty, the claimant, the litigant, said that he's growing a beard because he's Muslim. And so he was arguing for this kind of religious freedom, this religious claim, this freedom from discrimination. He wanted to practice his faith. Ultimately, the court concluded that he had never had a beard before. He had never, identified as that having been a part of his faith or a practice that he adhered to. And you're allowed to switch practices, but apparently after the case, he shaved. And so the court determined that based on what they could see, it didn't seem like it was an issue of faith. But again, you know, you're right that there is some mind reading. But what I like about the sincerity test, for lack of a better way of saying it, is it puts the ball in the court of the person claiming discrimination. And I think that's where the attention should always be. My problem, one of my problems, I have so many problems, but one of my problems with existing civil rights law is that we never really talk about the claimant, like the victim of discrimination, once we've determined that they're protected by the statute. The question is always whether or not the bad actor engaged in the bad act. And that's a critical question, of course. But I would love to see the law push more toward talking about the claim to identity, because I think ultimately what civil rights law is trying to do is calibrate the relationship between identity and equality and basically make it so we can live our lives as who we are. And so I would like to kind of shine the focus more on the people who are trying to fit in. It's not a perfect fit, I realize, and it will require re-engineering some aspects of the law. But I'm at least open to thinking that through and trying to figure out if making that change will enable us to get closer to our norms and ideals of equality.
I find your argument compelling, and I think another one of the side effects or benefits of moving from a focus on bias in the mind of the employer to sincerity in the heart of the claimant is that it lowers the temperature. If you're bringing a discrimination claim, you're saying this person has hate in their heart, they're biased against me, they're discriminating. And if the court finds for you, then there's an implicit kind of judgment and a guilty conscience on the part of the person who is found to have engaged in the discrimination. So even bringing the claim is kind of accusatory. Whereas when you switch to accommodating a person's sincerely held beliefs or practices, I think you lose that kind of moral element, and I think that can be productive.
Oh, I think you're totally right. That's a really great way of saying it too. I mean, there's a kind of a major and minor chord to my book, and the major chord is that ode to difference, but the minor chord is trying to introduce into civil rights law this obligation to give reasons, and this obligation to make people talk to each other, because I do think we are losing that art. And it is so charged when you say that someone engaged in discrimination. I'm not positive, but my law school memory, which is old now, tells me that saying that someone is accusing someone of being a racist is libel per se, I think. I'm not positive about that. Don't quote me, listeners. I am a firm believer, and I know that it's not a panacea, but I'm a firm believer in not just the concept of microaggressions, but the concept of microprogressions, right? I'm a firm believer that we can take tiny steps, and critical in taking tiny steps is forcing people to talk to each other and learn about each other and experience each other. One of the big problems with that mindset is it means people who are different bear the burden of teaching people, and that's not fair. But my response to that is it might be worth it, at least to some extent, to kind of help. But that's what I think is so magical about the workplace, right? The workplace has a special kind of alchemy because you are required to be there. Most people have to work. They need the money. You often don't get really any say in who you work with, and you are subservient to some sort of, kind of greater cause, sometimes a profit cause, sometimes a nonprofit cause. And you are forced to exist together. There's a legal scholar who's been very influential in my thinking named Cynthia Esland, who has a book called Working Together and a series of articles that led up to it. And it opened my eyes to this idea that one of the things that civil rights law is trying to do is to create this little microcosm of difference that will change us, and that when we leave and we go to our segregated communities and segregated along all different kinds of lines, that we will still be connected to the people who are different from us. One of the hard parts about that argument is I'm in academia, and that doesn't feel like my experience as much, and it might be more of a different type of work environment. But I still think there's a lot of good in the idea. And I love the opportunity to see people's minds change on topics that they just hadn't been exposed to, whether it is tattoos, whether it is piercings, whether it is skin color, whether it is religion. In my experience, most people, I can't say all, but most people want to give each other the benefit of the doubt. They just haven't had enough experience with each other. And so I'm trying to engineer the law in such a way to facilitate conversation in the hope that we can get beyond accusing each other. Because I do think there's also really interesting research that most people don't think they have bias, right? And most people think that's something other people have. And that makes it really hard to right wrongs when nobody wants to admit to that.
One of the benefits that a reader of your book will experience is that they will learn about and experience the differences of a number of people who you present throughout the book. Would you tell us about Ms. Jesperson?
Sure. Darlene Jesperson worked as a bartender in a sports bar located in a casino in Reno, Nevada. She worked there for a long time, and she was very good at her job. She had won, I don't know if there are awards for it, but she had received positive reviews. Her coworkers liked her. Her bosses liked her. Her customers liked her. She was good. She was good at her job. And she didn't wear makeup. That was a part of who she was. And that was fine with her employer. They had a preference for women who worked in the service component of that industry to wear makeup, but it wasn't required. And then at some point, they engineered a shift in their policy. They adopted a new policy that I think was called the Personal Best Program, which is like the most condescending name for some sort of grooming code at a workplace. Right. And what they did is terrible. Could you imagine? And they brought in a stylist, and the stylist did you over and then took your photo, and then you put your photo in your locker, and every day you had to look like your photo. It's a podcast, so it's not great for visuals, but if you do a search online for Darlene Jesperson, her picture will come up, and you can see what she looks like in her daily life and then what her personal best was at work. It was not her personal best. And when you see it, it just seems cruel to make people not look their personal best. And so the new rule for women is that women had to wear makeup. Men were forbidden from wearing makeup, and women had to. The average woman, I can't speak for them, but I don't know how strongly women will feel about that. I'm sure some women don't have a problem with it. I'm sure some women do have a problem with it. And I'm sure there are people, you know, on various sides of that range. It was a big problem for Darlene Jesperson. She tried to wear it and she couldn't make it work. And she ultimately told her bosses that. They said that it's required. They tried to find her another job that wouldn't be too much of a demotion. It didn't exist. And she ended up losing her job. Which to a lot of people seems strange that she would care that much about makeup. That's actually what I think is important about the case. But let me say one more thing before I go back to that. So she brought a lawsuit under the Civil Rights Act of 1964 alleging sex discrimination. And she made a bunch of arguments. One is about the different treatment between men and women. Women have to, men don't. The courts didn't buy that. And the other was that the makeup requirement was based on a gender stereotype. That women have to look a certain kind of way to be pretty. And the court ultimately concluded that it was not discrimination. And their way of doing that was to say that effectively the complaints of a single woman cannot amount to sex discrimination. And so what the court is really looking for is this kind of like broad narrative about all women, not one woman. Now, keep in mind, the statute says individual. Right. It doesn't ever talk about the groups. The group is never really mentioned. It's about individuals facing discrimination. But set that aside. What's really important to me, the thing that I put aside before, was that if you read the case, and if you read her her deposition testimony when they brought her in to ask her questions before a trial, she didn't talk about sex discrimination. She said things like, you know, I don't feel dignified when I wear makeup. I don't feel like myself. That I can't be who I am when I have to wear makeup. And so, you know, the heart of what she's talking about is that it's not sex discrimination, it's Darlene Jesperson discrimination, right? Now, there's no such thing as Darlene Jesperson discrimination. There's only sex discrimination. One of my arguments in the book is that stories like Darlene's matter because it matters when we capture that tipping point for a person, right? When we capture that identity trait that someone is not willing to sacrifice. And again, it, most people, it's probably not makeup, but for this one particular person, makeup was essential to who she was. So in the sense of not wearing makeup, and she didn't want to be someone else. And I like the idea of the law caring about those core identities, because there are core identities in American law and American civil rights law. And sometimes they are the critical identity for other people. But we all know in our lives, there are other parts of identities that sometimes take priority and they're very contextual. I tended in the book, and the book is just, it's overflowing with stories. It really is a storytelling book more, in a lot of ways more than a law book. I described it to someone as a book about people with a tiny bit of law in it. The kind of through line of all of these stories, it's just people who have an identity that is very important to them. And for some reason, the employer can't make it work. And I'm trying to find ways to see if we can force the employer and the employee to find common ground to see if they can make space. Because ultimately, I think that's what we all want, right? Is we all want the space to be who we are to the best extent possible.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Does Darlene Jesperson's case come out differently if she has an allergy to makeup?
It totally does, because then it's a disability, which again, I understand why that's the case, but I do think we should interrogate as a legal community why the identity traits that we get that are completely out of our control are set aside in one pot, and then the ones that are in our control are another pot. Because I think when you draw the line firmly as just purely biology, and in certain cases, medical, we lose sense of a lot of what identity is. Is oftentimes identity is about choice. I'm of the mind that, for example, you can't talk about, you know, these hair discrimination cases without talking about race. But there's volition in all of those hair discrimination cases because people choose how to style their hair. And so the law has decided when you have a qualified disability that you're in this kind of other hopper of protection. And I support that, but I do think that we shouldn't only protect identity traits that we are born with, because I value choice. And I actually think that our identities change over time, and they change, sometimes from moment to moment, but really we require the ability to explore who we are. And there are a lot of identity traits that change. And I'm not just thinking about gender identity and trans status. I think about this in religion. I think about this in politics. I think about this in the kind of way you approach the world. It would be different. And it's not the kind of thing that I easily accept.
There are, two competing visions of equality that you talk about. And you say that sameness and difference are distinct, but not contradictory.
Right.
Can you tell us what the role of difference is in your program?
Sure. Let me go sameness first, though, because I think it's best to talk about difference once you hit sameness, because I do think that sameness is the core of American Civil Rights Act. And the basic idea is that fundamentally, we are all the same, right? And the goal is to get rid of identity traits. And so there is this, I would say, fervent strain in American Civil Rights law that we should be blind to identity traits, that we should not see race, we should not see color, we should not see sex. The goal is to completely take them off the table. And so that's one way of doing equality, right? Is to say that these identity traits don't matter. And so we should treat people as if they are fundamentally the same.
I just wanted to say, I think that is the core of the bias determination, where we say, did this characteristic factor into your decision making? Mm-hmm. If you treated someone differently because of their sex or their race or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's American law has taken, like, it's like sameness on steroids, right? There's all of these cases where they try to get to such granular points of proving how similarly situated people are that oftentimes you can't find someone to compare yourself to. You know, I'm a firm believer that there is difference within groups. And I tend to think about this, you know, in my own life and all of the identity traits that I have and all the ways that I live. But I think that, you know, and I feel comfortable saying that no two Jews are the same, that, you know, people live their life, you know, in a lot of ways where they're the same as other people of that identity, but then also in ways that they're different. And so I am interested in a vision of equality that says we will protect you because you are different, right? We will protect you in the ways, we'll protect the ways in which you're different, right? The ways in which you live your life differently than other people. And a lot of what I'm hoping the law can do is allow people to articulate that, because I do think there's this kind of truth and reconciliation value of saying, this is who I am and this is what I need. And then an employer turning around and saying, well, this is what we need and this is what we can make work. And I think there's value in that conversation. And so I don't know how scandalous it is to say that we are all not the same, because I think in a lot of ways, sometimes we are. I mean, there is no question that when you are talking about obvious bias and sometimes even hate, you know, just being a certain way, just having that identity trait means you are exposed to bias. And so there are certain kinds of bias that people will experience because of who they are. And it is similar along certain axes. And I try to gesture toward that pretty, actually it's not even a gesture. I talk about that in a later part of the book as a means of trying to reconcile how I can possibly justify protecting people with tattoos on the same level as people who are facing race discrimination, as an example. I don't know how satisfying my answers are, but I'm sensitive to it. But I do think, again, the more difference we are exposed to, the better it is for everybody, is my my headline.
Well, I think that the difference between the protection that is afforded for race discrimination, for example, it's a different kind of protection than is afforded for disability or for religion. Race discrimination is not allowed whatsoever. Religious discrimination is combated by requiring reasonable accommodation.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what that protection entails?
Sure. So there are only a small handful of identity traits that have this reasonable accommodation protection. The two big ones are, as you mentioned, religion and disability. The other ones that off the top of my head I can think of are veteran status and certain statutes. And then also under Obamacare, there is an accommodation provision for mothers who are breastfeeding and who need time and space to express milk. However, that provision doesn't have a cause of action linked to it. So you can't sue.
Okay.
aspirational, but it's a good step, I think. We didn't get the whole way.
Sure.
It's a good step. So the way reasonable accommodation works is if you have these identities that receive this protection, you are afforded this ability to expect your employers to take steps to accommodate your identity, to make space for what you need. So in the disability context, imagine that it's an interpreter or it's some sort of access, maybe a ramp or an elevator. And so in that situation, the employer must in fact engage in a kind of discrimination, right? The employer must take steps to remold the workplace around you. There is this saying that you'll see repeated over and over again in civil rights cases, that the goal of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act is to prevent employers from introducing bias into the workplace. And so that's the prohibition on that kind of classic disparate treatment side. And reasonable accommodation, the employer is in effect introducing, I wouldn't call it bias, but they're introducing difference into the equation because they are requiring affirmative steps on the employer's part to make space and remodel as needed. The disability protection is different from the religion protection in two ways. One is there are harder definitions to get into the disability context under the ADA and then with the ADA recent amendments and then as compared to the religion. And then secondly, the reasonable accommodation standard for disability is what I'd say is lower, right? Employers have a more obligation to accommodate disability than they do religion, although the kind of central framework is the same. So it is a difference in that the employer must take steps to make space. And to let the cat out of the bag, my argument is that we should be moving more towards an accommodation model for identity more largely, because I do think it will have this kind of wholesale trickle down benefit for all people.
I think one of the benefits that I identified when I was thinking about this is, especially in light of your discussion of the boxes that people are trying to force themselves into.
Yeah.
The current civil rights regime kind of sounds like the old sides of court distinction between law and equity.
Yeah.
Where you had to file the correct pleading, and if you brought this as an action in Trover, for example, and it was incorrect, then you're shut out.
Yeah.
And we've moved to a single unified complaint system where you stake your facts and your prayer for relief,
mm-hmm.
and then the court evaluates that holistically.
Yeah. Totally.
And it seems like you're calling for a similar move within civil rights.
Can I tell you how much I love that? If it's okay, I'm going to steal that so aggressively. It's funny, I teach, one of the classes I teach is property. And we spend a lot of time talking, not just about Trover, but just the distinction between law and equity, the collapse of law and equity. And property law is one of those rare fields that still, in a lot of ways, loves the distinction between law and equity. And I'm an equity guy, right? Not surprisingly. And I'm deep in the ways of equity. And so I love the way you're talking about that because it's totally true. And if one of the things that I did is I went and I looked at all of these employment discrimination, that litigation manuals, like advice from practitioners, how do you litigate these places specifically on the plaintiff side? It's all about, latching yourself and anchoring to a protected class. And it's always protected class. Even though those are, those are made up words, right? They're not in the statute. That's why I always try to talk about protected traits, because I think there's value in, repurposing and refocusing that word. But I think it's a great idea because I think that so much is lost as we try to craft ourselves, onto these existing forms, whether they're, law claims or equity claims. And again, for me, the area that I wrote about first, these gender and sex cases and the sexuality cases, I've become pretty disillusioned about, a lot of the arguments that I myself had made for many years, trying to show why, sexual orientation discrimination is in fact a form of sex discrimination. And I think it is, right? I want to be clear. I fully believe that when we, engage in stereotyping behavior about gay people, men and women, it is motivated by gender, and it is motivated by ideas about how men and women are supposed to act. And I firmly believe that. But I don't know that the law is remotely equipped to unpack any of that. And, you know, to me, I've kind of landed in this place where I don't think the law should be doing that, right? Because I just don't think it's good at it. And I don't think that's unique to that context. I think there's lots of context in identity cases and civil rights cases where the law is just fumbling. And so people like me, and people like you, and lots of, you know, people who care about this stuff are constantly trying to advocate and teach and to, you know, give a broader, more holistic understanding. But, you know, it's not really the way that law was designed to work, which is part of why, you know, I'm arguing in the book that there's not a lot of tools we use for modern problems that were built in the 60s. And it just seems to me, it's not clear that the tools we have right now are equipped for the way we live identity today.
As I mentioned, I found your argument very compelling. And I'm curious how you think it could be actualized. If the tools that we currently have are anachronistic or maladjusted to current circumstances, can we implement what you're advocating for within the current statutory regime?
That's right. So you know, I don't claim to have written a practical book. It's not, you know, there's, I mean, like, you know, this, I have the word utopian occurs in the book and not as a criticism. And so, you know, I don't necessarily do practical in this book, although I do think there's a practical lesson to draw from it. I don't think, you know, one of the questions someone asked me early on when I showed some drafts was, what would the statute look like? And they were so, you know, underwhelmed with my answer, which was, I have no idea, because I'm not really in that phase where I'm saying this is how we do it. You know, I am satisfied if someone comes away from the book thinking at least a little more curiously about, or thinking that we could talk about identity a little bit better in law. That's a huge win for me. If we can, like, just think about all of the different ways that identity manifests in civil rights law, I take that as a big win. And partly, you know, one of my hopes was just to display people's stories. Because I think that one of the great benefits of civil rights law is that people are heard. And, you know, in my experience, a lot of people don't really care about the outcome of their case as much as they care about, you know, an opportunity to speak. It's not even about the day in court. It's about, someone has to listen to what I need. And so that's a value to me too. You know, practically, I don't know. I don't know that we are in a position to do what I would hope to do, in large part because the law is going the other way. If anything, I'm arguing for a way to get the law to broaden open, but it's pretty clear to me that the law is closing further shut. It's harder and harder to win a discrimination case. I don't see any way that gets better in the short run. And, you know, civil rights laws are really hard to change. They change, you know, I'm writing about mostly about federal law, a little bit about state law. They're easier to change at state law. And there's been some pretty great changes in recent years at the state level that give me hope. I mean, New York's ban on hair discrimination is amazing. You know, all of the movement on various sex and gender laws at the state level, some accommodation protections for you know, working mothers and pregnant women, that gives me hope. But I think ultimately being a civil rights attorney is a very sad job. But again, let me just say, hopefully, civil rights law is all about promise. It's all about wanting the absolute best for, you know, people, and wanting our society to work in a way where we, you know, look out for, you know, the little guy. We look out for the people who need the most protection. And so I am hopeful that at least people will, my book will at least make people think about some of that. And maybe someone smarter than me can come up with a way to fix it. Because there's plenty of those people out there. And I have high hopes. So, yeah.
Well, I was trying to think about it because in the passage that I read when we first started talking, mm-hmm. You exhort the reader to imagine this alternative. And you do that a few times through the book. And I was trying to think, okay, who's the person who's doing that imagining? Is it a judge? Is it a plaintiff's attorney? Is it a legislator? And you talk about this in the book, but there's a gap between what the law can actually accomplish and what our lived experience is. And it seems to me, I really think that HR managers should read this book.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Because there's no reason why a corporation can't implement a program like this.
Totally. Yep.
They're required to implement anti-race discrimination measures and religious accommodation measures, but they could go above and beyond. They could implement a right to personality.
That's such a great point. And they do, right? I mean, we know from experience that corporate America is a first mover in anti-discrimination protections, right? Because they want the best workforce and they want to hire the best talent and they want to create the best working environment. Now, it's not always perfect. And I think recent years have seen that on display. But they have the ability to make change well before the law. That's a really great suggestion. It's interesting too, because I've done a lot of reading and a little bit of writing just about harassment, and the relationship between HR and harassment is fraught. But it seems to me what I am really talking about is, and my targets, even though I didn't think about them as I was writing and I didn't really write to them, it's not just HR, it's not just employers, it's also employees. Because, as we go to work, we have a lot built up in our minds about, who we are and what we need. And oftentimes we don't communicate that. And so, I've been in administration for quite a few years now at my college, the law school I teach at. The advice I give all of the faculty here is to just tell me what they need. I want to do whatever I can to make it work to the extent that I have the power, because I want them to thrive in the workplace. And I don't think employees think about that sort of thing. And in some workplaces, you're effectively told, you can't. But to the extent that you can, communicating your needs, I think, has a lot of power, because it forces people to talk to you about your life. And if more people do it, it becomes more accepted. And I realize that I have a lot of privilege, and it's very easy for me to say these sorts of things. And I'm well aware of that, and I want to recognize that. But I'm talking to employees too. And ultimately, I would love for employees, employers to find balance, however that's possible. But I love the HR thing. That's great.
I think that insofar as employees can think about what you're proposing, I think that there are two benefits. One is what we touched on earlier is moving from these accidental characteristics to intentional characteristics, that you get to decide who you are. You get to decide how you engage with the world. And that is just as important as the things that you didn't decide. Mm-hmm. And related to that, building on that, which of these things are important to you? Which are the ones that you consider, I believe with Ms. Jesperson, you said it goes to who she is as a person.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that conversation that people could have with themselves, I think that's really a healthy thing.
I agree with you completely. I think that's great. Yep. Well said.
So thank you for writing this book. Thank you doing this interview.
I appreciate it. This is really fun. I'm grateful that you wanted to take the time to talk about my book.
Well, it's a real treat for me. You have another book that you're working on, or
I am working on two projects. I'll tell you about them. I'm working on two projects. One that's very personal. I was involved in a lawsuit many years ago, where I was sued, and I was a litigant. The case was ultimately dismissed. One of the things that I've learned about that case is It has changed the way I think about how litigation works. A lot of people told me that the person who sued me had no claim. It was ultimately dismissed. I have found that I am the most sympathetic to that person of anyone I've talked to. I'm interested in that. I'm writing about that. I'm also, believe it or not, writing something that I hope is a book one day about lawyers and clients who have sex. And the model rules of ethical conduct prohibit lawyers and clients from engaging in sexual acts together. I am making an argument against that rule, strangely enough. And the argument is that there's a similar rule prohibiting lawyers and clients from engaging in business practices. However, there are safety valves that allow the lawyers and clients to do it, provided the lawyer takes certain steps. I'm writing a paper that argues we should not necessarily be so comfortable with this idea that greed is somehow better than lust, or that lust is worse than greed. And I'm hoping to turn that into a book, and people will hate me. But that's great. So those are some of the things I'm working on.
Well, I think that's very intriguing. And thanks. I think that
will you talk about it with me in a couple of years?
I'd be very happy to. That's great. An imaginative reevaluation of how we draw lines.
Yeah, that's
right. And I think that's what you did very well in Outsiders.
Thank you. That's kind. I appreciate that.
So our guest today was Zachary Kramer. Again, the book is Outsiders from Oxford University Press. It is out now. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.